Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald. You've seen him on Animal Planet. He has a biography now, autobiography really, called It Started with a Turtle, One Man's Life on a Blue and Green Planet. And I could also add, by the way, another subtext to this, and how I came out of my shell, because that's part of the story, in a sense, Dr. Fitzgerald. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my gosh. It's my pleasure to talk to you. It always is. All right. Let's start with the title. It Started with a Turtle. You are known as a veterinarian who treats and has for many years treated more than just dogs and cats. In fact, on Animal Planet, that was the focus. When there was a snake that had a problem, it was you, Dr. Fitzgerald, that solved that emergency problem, or a turtle that needed to come out of its shell. So talk about how it all began with a turtle.
Well, in the 50s, unfortunately, the little dime store turtles were very popular, and you're a baby, so you don't remember.
Thank you.
but you know, I'm 73. I read it at 74-year-old level. You know, so that's good. So in the 50s, these little dinosaur turtles were very popular. Little red-eared sliders.
Yeah.
It was a shame, you know, they were sold in huge numbers, and they were, all of them were wild caught, and they probably didn't survive very long. It just the kids. The problem with many pets, as you know, Steve, is that the kids are really excited in the very beginning, but then the thing kind of languishes on a shelf. Nobody pays attention to it, and you know, but they're living creatures that share our life force. So we are duty bound for any animal that we domesticate or take on to take care of. You know, and so this started with a turtle. It was my first animal, little Sam, a little dinosaur turtle, and the story of him. But I think we all have great stories. And during COVID, I was able to sit down for 2 years and get them all together on paper.
Well, one of those stories is how you decided to become a veterinarian in the first place. Talk about that.
Well, I've been lucky. I've been like Forrest Gump. To be in the right place at the right time. And I put myself through school, undergrad and graduate school and veterinary school, doing security for bands, and was very lucky. And worked for Barry Fay, the promoter here out of Denver, and for Bill Graham, and got to work with different bands, you know, Willie Nelson and The Who and the Rolling Stones. And so you would just kind of do the advance and figure out how you could get your band from the airport to the hotel and the hotel to the venue and back and forth and, you know, keep away the people and it was exciting in those days, the late 60s and early 70s when I did it, and we didn't know what would happen when you get 75,000 kids in a place, you know, and it was going on. It was the late 70s and I've been doing it for over a decade and longer, and I was working for the Stones. I was with Jimmy Callahan, my boss, and I asked Keith. I said, "Man, I got a chance to maybe go to school. Maybe, what do you think?" And he goes, "Oh man, you can't be a bouncer when you're 50. You definitely go to school. I'll help you. I'll write you a recommendation. Whatever you need." You know, he's been with us. What tour is it? 69, 72, 75, 78. This is the 78 tour. He goes, "Yeah, come on. You know." And I don't know if they thought it was going to last forever, you know. I mean, you worry, the fans are always worried about being the flavor of the month, and, you know, the things pass. It's hard, I think, in entertainment to keep relevant always, right? So you're worried about that. So, but it was the best advice ever from Keith Richards.
All right, so I want to talk about that a little bit. You kind of slid by that when you said, well, when Keith told me, And I'm thinking, he's talking about Keith Richards. So what was it like to actually know the Rolling Stones when you were so young? I mean, did you realize that these guys are icons that you have an opportunity to work with, really, in a sense?
Well, that's right. That's right. But you're not part of it. You're not part of that. You're working for them, you know, so you have a job to do. And so it's very different. But still, I mean, you're starstruck. And but then after you work with them and realize that they're people, that, and the Stones are good people, and they're so organized. It was like the Marine Corps, you know, and Jimmy Callahan, my boss, it was a great experience for me to learn about human nature and dealing with crowds and dealing with people. And so you're dealing with the difficult people in the crowds, or you're dealing with, hiring the police in that town or the bouncers from that town and weight room people or rugby teams or, you know, maybe football players. You know, you get some big, hopefully big gentle guys that if something happened, they could do something, but you don't want bloody mouths, you know, you don't want lawsuits, or you want people to come in safely and have a good time at the show.
Of course. Now, one more question about the Stones. If you wrote about it in the book, I missed it. So were they smoking things? Were they excessively partying? I mean, this is many years later. You can tell me the truth.
Well, like I said, I was working for them, so I wasn't partying with them. So I wasn't privy to what was going on always. But it seemed like there were a lot of girls around.
What a surprise. How often was Jagger married? Like 23 times or something like that. So you become a veterinarian. I want to talk later about the Animal Planet show, but show business never was too far away from you. And I'm not at the moment talking about the Animal Planet show. So you wrote about, I'm a young guy still, I'm backstage, and I'm having a conversation, you say, and getting advice from a guy by the name of George Burns.
Well, I was doing security. He came through and he didn't really need a lot of security. But,
no.
You know, they were worried somebody bump him or you don't know. You don't know with these people. There's odd people that follow him or whatever. I mean, you know what made me so sad was that with the Rolling Stones, we took a picture of the crowd every morning in front of the hotel. If you saw the same guy in a different city, you knew he was following you. So we'd go out and find out who he was and shake him down a little bit and see if he had a gun on him or whatever. And, you know, that guy stood in front of the Dakota for 2 weeks with John Lennon. Mm. And you know, that wouldn't have happened with us. And so with George Burns, he was the nicest guy ever. And you know, I said, "Oh, Mr. Burns, you know, you've seen it all, vaudeville, radio, music, movies, television, you know, you've seen it. What's the secret of comedy?" He said, "Well, there's only five jokes." He said, "There's a current event joke where something's happening." He said, "You know, those are great." He said, "There's a sex joke. Don't do those. Those can be offensive. There's an ethnic joke. Don't do those." He said, "The fourth kind is the self-deprecating joke where you make fun of yourself. So, you know, I wear glasses and can tell the crowd I wear thick glasses. My glasses are pretty thick. When I was little, I couldn't go to national parks. Or anything I looked at burst into flames, you know." And so my girlfriend said, "Why'd you get contacts?" And I didn't have a heart to tell her that these are contacts. she's my glasses. So he said the fourth kind. And I said, "Well, Mr. Burns, the fifth kind." He goes, "Oh, yeah, that's a boat act." "A boat act?" He goes, "Yeah, a guy on a cruise ship. He's got a talking duck or a ventriloquist. You know, he's got a guitar in front of him, you know." So stand-up, I think, is a different animal because you really don't have anything to hide behind. You don't have a guitar. You just have your voice and you know, vocal inflections and the stories you tell and the jokes you tell.
Or in the case of George Burns, a cigar. But you ended up doing stand-up, and we'll talk about what led you to that. And boy, oh boy, a successful stand-up comedian. After you dried off, I'll explain what I mean by that, or you will, all when we come back with one of the most noted veterinarians in America, Dr. Kevin Fitzgerald, the author of It Started With a Turtle on WGN. The book is called It Started With a Turtle, One Man's Life on a Blue and Green Planet. Not that you were necessarily incredibly introverted, but you kind of came out of your shell like those turtles do as well when you began to do stand-up comedy. And we were talking about how you got advice from a guy who knows how to do that, George Burns, at the time. He must have been, even though you were young, he still must have been himself young, probably 90 years old at the time. I don't know. How well, I actually have met George Burns as well, and he was well into his 90s. And I don't remember our conversation as much as I do the cigar smoke. We were in his small dressing rooms, and most dressing rooms are small, and there was no ventilation, and he had been puffing on the cigar for who knows how long, and I walk in, hey, kid, and then he's smoking his cigar, and I was like, as I barely can get out the questions, but he was very, very nice, as you point out.
Very, very gracious. The only guy I ever saw that wore sock garters.
What are those?
They hold your socks up, and they go
really?
Around your shin, and it's old-time stuff. What he would do was, he didn't want to put his pants on in the dressing room and sit and wreck the crease on his tuxedo pants.
Wow.
So he would walk around in his boxer shorts with a cummerbund on and his shirt and his shoes, and his pants were so big, you could put them on over his shoes. But yeah, he was great. He was very gracious and so funny, so funny. And I'd rather sing than eat. Most people would rather hear me eat. things like that. So clever.
Yeah.
And so sweet, just gracious, very gracious. And he got me into the cigars.
Oh, really? It was, so you, this is not in the book. So you, or I didn't see it anyway, you became a cigar smoker because of George Burns?
He always had him going, and he goes, the thing about cigars is the brotherhood, he was having a cigar with somebody and telling stories and looking into the blue smoke and then, this stuff comes out and it, you don't like to smoke a cigar by yourself. It's a social thing. The only thing that can wreck a good cigar is sitting next to a jerk.
Okay. I don't smoke cigars, so I'll take your word for that. I'm thinking a lot of things are not helpful if you're sitting next to a jerk. So you began doing stand-up comedy, and you were known at some point as the diving comic. Explain what that is and how you transitioned to stand-up comedy that we all know. Some dude talking up on stage and saying funny things. And for you, it was often, and it still is, about veterinary medicine.
Well, veterinary medicine lends itself well to great stories, and so the book is full of them, and so it's a wonderful, wonderful source of humor and of learning, and it's veterinary medicine it's been a wonderful, wonderful career for me the last 43 years. It's been great, and still doing it, still practice every day. But the thing about the comedy, in the beginning, you don't know about the craftsmanship of writing jokes. Maybe you don't have jokes, and maybe you're going to do a visual comic create these little things. I had this tank, and it was an old phone booth, and we puttied the sides, and it would fold up. But you could fill it up with water. And so when we were little, my brother and I, we could turn the canoe over and pull it down, and there's still air underneath, and scare my mother. We'd walk on the bottom, and you had a couple of minutes of air in the canoe underneath and walk on the bottom. So my brother goes, hey, this would be great. You get a bucket with a microphone in it, and you could pull the bucket over your head, and it'd be air in it, trap the air. And so you had maybe 3 or 4 minutes. So you'd tell folks, ladies and gentlemen, I'm the world's only diving comic. And you had a lady swimming suit with a big flower, and one of my mother's swimming caps that went really tight and made my face bulge out. And And so it was horrifying looking. And then drop the towel and get up on the ladder, walk up into the top of the tank and submerge. And then put the bucket over your head, right, and as you submerge. And then you could get at the bottom of the tank and tell jokes, you know, and say, you know, I had a date with twins last night. You know, ask me if I got lucky. Yes and no. You know, why do mermaids wear seashells? B-shells are too small. It was, you know, it was all jokes like this, you know, and just one liners because you didn't have that much air. And then you came up. The problem is you had to drain the tank and fill it, and it wasn't a great thing. The other thing I did was a dying comic where I had a hospital bed, roll it out on the stage, have the MC say, "Folks, I don't know what happened, but we have a dying comic," and the doc said there's one chance in a million. If you laugh, you might get stronger.
Yep.
And so I'd go out, you know, and the oxygen tank, and he had things over, you know, and said, "Yo, what do you call a Hispanic with a rubber toe? Roberto." You know, and so you'd be doing jokes like that. And
that didn't that all didn't go over all that well. I mean, I've seen you perform only once, and it was just you walking up on stage without a prop and just telling jokes.
No, it didn't go at all.
Yeah, I understand. So we only, unbelievably, we only have about a minute and a half here left. So I want to get back to veterinary medicine. Tell me about the Animal Planet show, Emergency Vets, in that time, and maybe one recollection.
We did Emergency Vets for 11 seasons, you know, Emergency Vets and then Emergency Vets Interns. And it was not staged or scripted, and it was the very beginning of reality TV. And along with the Crocodile Hunter, we were the first Animal Planet shows. And we were the only ones that had, so they had to show us so often and burn us down so quickly. But we did it for 11 years, and it was we didn't know what television was. And as the producers would decide what things would be and followed, and they liked drama and trauma, dun 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 dun. And then things we thought they thought were too dry. So, you know, but they liked the happy endings. They liked it when the little cat would be going home and then go to the house and film. And the Animal Planet at the time was in 92 million homes in the United States, 110 million homes in the rest of the world. And you think if they tell the people they're going to come and film your house, give them tons of heads up, don't you think you'd clean up a little bit? The place was always in shambles.
Oh, no.
We got to this old lady's house to see her cat come home, and the old lady had curlers on. And I got to thinking, you know, where is she going after this? And more than 200 million people are going to see her.
Well, unfortunately, Dr. Fitzgerald, you won't believe it, but we're out of time. But I can have you back again if you are willing. It started with a turtle, one man's life on a blue and green planet. This book is filled with so many funny anecdotes and some really interesting about veterinary medicine as well. I thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, we'll drag you back in at some point. Chicago has a couple of them, cat cafes. And the whole idea is the cats can be adopted out in these cat cafes. One's at Treehouse Humane Society right there, right at the animal shelter. However, there's something new. Cat cafes came from Japan. This idea did also. The Capybara Cafe in St. Augustine, Florida. Capybaras are rodents. They're the largest rodent in the world, weighing over 100 pounds. They're about 4 feet long or longer. They live in the Amazon basin, and they are really friendly. They love and adore human attention, especially if they're raised by humans. The thing is, though, you can't go to the cafe and adopt out a capybara. And if you go to St. Augustine, Florida tomorrow, you can't just walk in. You need an appointment to do so, and you can make one of those online, the Capybara Cafe. He is one of my favorite dancing partners on the radio, Wayne Pacelli, who is founder and president of the Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action. And I know of no one who's taken more action for animals over the course of a couple of decades now, advocating often politically to benefit companion animals and also animals, production animals, any sort of animal at all, including those in labs. And I will let you, Wayne, explain. I mean, you know what? When I saw the press release from the FDA, I actually thought, because it came, I don't know, maybe what, a week, 2 weeks after April 1st, April Fool's. So I thought, okay, this is some sort of April Fool's joke. This can't be. But it is. I will let you explain.
Well, Steve, thank you for having me on. And yes, it's a very big announcement in the realm of animal testing. Everybody knows that animals, you know, mice, rats, but also beagles, primates, are used in various tests. We test animals to screen chemicals for safety, pesticides for safety. There's also biomedical research and basic research. But the biggest category of all of animal testing is to use animals to screen new drugs. There are drugs for everything because this is at the center of our health maintenance strategies and attacking illness. So there are drugs to address cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, pain drugs, there are bone drugs, there's toe fungus drugs, there's weight loss drugs, you name it, we have drugs for it. Since 1938, Steve, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act has required extensive multi-species, multi-year tests on animals before those drugs go to human clinical trials. In 2022, we at the Center for Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action spearheaded an effort in Congress to eliminate that animal testing mandate. That mandate meant that every person who has a conscience about animals but who takes drugs was drawing drugs from a process that involved hurting animals. There was no such thing as a cruelty-free drug. Many of you listening have heard of cruelty-free cosmetics. It means the mascaras, lipsticks, other household products, self-development products were not tested on animals because they used other methods to get them there. But for drugs, there was no other way that it was done. It was mandated by law. We lifted the mandate, and now the newly confirmed FDA commissioner, Dr. Marty McCarry, who came out of Johns Hopkins University, the first public act he did was to say, we're going to get away from this model of using animals. We're going to rely on 21st century screening methods that are grounded on human biology, and we're going to stop killing millions of animals a year for drug screening. It's one of the biggest announcements, Steve. You and I have been involved in animal welfare for many years. This is one of the biggest announcements ever for the cause of animal welfare.
And I want to talk about two parts of this. One part is what this will do for animal lives. And we're talking about a wide variety of species here, including some that folks like Dr. Jane Goodall for years have been saying, we don't need to do this anymore, just like years ago, as you point out, we didn't need to do this for cosmetics anymore. But also how this will, all right, some of you may be listening while you're listening to this show, if you're thinking, I don't care about animals, I don't know. But if you're thinking that, this also means drug prices for you can actually go down. Can you address both those parts?
Yes. I mean, on the drug pricing, to take the latter one, animal tests have proved not predictive of the human reaction to drugs. So the government mandated, until we passed the FDA Modernization Act 2.0 in 2022, mandated that all these drugs had to go through extensive animal tests. The data show that in cases where the animal tests allow a drug to proceed to its next stage, a phase one or phase two, before it goes to human clinical trials, it passed muster in the animal tests. So they use beagles, or they use primates, or they use mice. It cleared it, go to human clinical trials, and in 90 to 95% of the cases, the drug failed in the human clinical trials. So that means that all of that money, hundreds of millions of dollars for each drug trial, was lost because you went through all these years of animal tests, then you go to the human clinical trials where people volunteer to participate in a clinical trial, then it fails. The drug developer, like a Merck or a Pfizer or an AstraZeneca, has to start anew. So when there is a winning drug, when the drug gets all the way from concept into the market, the drug has to pay for all of those failures. 9 of every 10 drugs fail when they go to human clinical trials. that's one explanation for the very high cost of drugs. I mean, this is a major political issue. This is what you hear discussed and debated during presidential debates. What about the high cost of drugs? What are we going to do about that? They talk about imports, and they talk about, you know, the pharmaceutical companies not raking in the money. Well, one thing they should have been talking about is all of the inefficiency built into the R&D process. So we're addressing that issue. In terms of your first question, the animals, I mean, so many different animals are used. I mean, 100,000 primates a year, many of them taken from Cambodia in the wild, used to be China, but that stopped after COVID-19. 50,000 dogs, most of them beagles. Steve, I think you know I'm a beagle lover, I'm a beagle owner, and, you know, these animals are very docile. They allow you to move them around in their beds. You know, you can kind of, you know, nuzzle right up to them. They're so gentle, and it's that docility that sometimes has caused the drug screeners to use them, because they're easy to handle and manage in a laboratory setting. This is an enormous number of animals used where they're suffering from pain and distress and long-term confinement, no human socialization, no human loving touch. And if we can do this a better way and get better outcomes, where we can do safety testing to make sure that the drugs we take don't hurt us, and if we can make sure that the drugs are effective, that they're actually doing what they say they're going to do. If they're a cancer-fighting drug, they're going to fight cancer. If they're a heart medicine, they're going to, you know, give you a regular heartbeat. You know, all of these things that drugs are advertised to do. And I'll say, Steve, that the existing model is so broken that you listen to these commercials on TV about drugs, and they have all these side effects that take up, you know, 55 of the 60 seconds in the ad, or the narrator saying, oh, you could lose your knee, you could swallow your tongue, you could have extreme depression.
Swallow your tongue. I'd have not heard that one. But I want to play devil's advocate just a little bit. Oh, and one thing I will say is that the people that care for the lab animals really have done the best of their ability to care for these animals. I don't know that you would question that, but I don't doubt that they care about the animals. But I also, as I said, want to play devil's advocate. We will do that when we come back with Wayne Pacelli, the CEO and president of Animal Wellness Action and Center for the Humane Economy. When we do come back on WGN, he is Wayne Pacelli, who has done so much good for animals throughout his career, some of which we talk about, some of which you never hear about. Center for the Humane Economy, Animal Wellness Action. He's president and CEO. Check these organizations out, because they do, in fact, do so much good, much more than we'll have time to cover on the radio. And you talked about how an announcement was made that was so surprising that I actually thought it was some sort of freaky April Fool's joke coming a little late, and that is, we are going to move to stop experimentation for pharmaceuticals, experimentation in air quotes, on pharmaceuticals for drugs ultimately for us that are tested on animals first, or animal testing. And I wonder if some of this crosses over to food testing as well, because it comes from the FDA. Sometimes our food is tested, or certain ingredients are, with animals. Is this going to impact that, if nothing else, in a philosophical way, do you think, Wayne?
I think that there's going to be spillover to these other categories of animal use. And, you know, Steve, it's Food and Drug Administration, right? So this is an agency that regulates food and drug, but the drug has been a much bigger part of the portfolio for this agency. And we're talking about pharmaceuticals. These are global companies, some based in the U.S., some based in Europe, some based in Asia, but they're operating and selling drugs all over the world. It's a $1.35 trillion industry. So when you think about this and the use of animals in drug screening, this accounts for 75% of all animal testing and research done. Everything else is smaller in terms of scale, in terms of animal use, because our health system is built around drug delivery, palliatives, treatments, cures. The problem is, there are so many failures of these drugs because the animal testing has not properly screened them and does not forecast the human reaction to drugs, that we have 9 failures in the drug development process for everyone that gets to market. That means that these drug companies have to chase the most commercially valuable drugs, like the weight loss drugs, like Ozempic or Wegovy or the Alzheimer's drugs or the heart disease drugs. But we have 7,000 diseases that afflict people. We have so many illnesses that there's no drug development at all because they don't fit into this blockbuster model of going for the biggest drugs with the biggest commercial bang because the R&D costs have been driven so high by the animal tests because it's so inefficient. And Dr. McCarry, the new FDA commissioner who came in with the Trump administration, he has said, we're going to rid our government process of these inefficient animal tests and use 21st century strategies that are more reliable, more effective, less costly. That means lower drug prices for patients. It means more drugs to address more diseases. It's a win-win for animals and patients.
And on your website, Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action, you can see the exact wording of the press release, which describes everything you are saying. But then my question is, what do we do to test these drugs? Because it's important that we know the drugs are safe and effective for humans. So what do we do instead?
It's incredible, Steve. I've been to some of these laboratories, and I went up to the Harvard Wyss Institute, and at the Wyss Institute, they've developed liver on a chip and kidney on a chip. They basically create a model of a human kidney or a liver. Those are two of the organs that are involved in filtering out toxins. So you're basically using human biology, and you're seeing if the drug has a reaction or causes toxicity in the organ. It's much better than testing on a beagle or a primate. All of the results that have been derived from these studies on these alternative methods are superior, which was really the basis for Dr. McCarry, the new FDA commissioner, making this declaration. When you have a system where the failure rate is 90 to 95%, the animal tests are so non-predictive of the human reaction to drugs, but then you have human biology-based methods that are organoids or organs-on-a-chip programs, it's just so much better. It's amazing, Steve, that it took us this long. But this was 84 years of a model in the 1930s when it was developed. Maybe animals were the best proxy for humans to address the very issue that you mentioned. Hey, what are we going to do? We have to make sure these drugs don't kill us. But what we found is that the animals just weren't predictive. And these new methods that are using human biology are much more reliable. So that's why it's going to be a win for everybody.
As you know, I'm on the board of the Every Cat Health Foundation. I'm not on the scientific advisory board. I do get to sit in on those meetings. And several years ago, and the same is true on the dog side for what I'm about to say. So several years ago, when organoids were a thing or became a thing to look at, researchers on the veterinary side said, hooray. And of course, it's never been the other way around. We do not test drugs for cats and dogs on people to see if they work on cats and dogs. That's never been done.
That's a great point.
And I don't think it's not going to be done. Having said that, there are a lot of drugs, the same drugs, cancer drugs come to mind as one example, that work for both. It's called One Health. That occurs more often with dogs than cats, but it certainly occurs with cats as well. Drugs that work for people and for animals. But this is not the way we had been doing it, to determine if that's the case. And that wasn't the goal. These were healthy dogs, not dogs with a certain type of cancer, for example, that a certain chemotherapy was tried on, for lack of a better way of saying it, and then to see if it would work later in people. That's not what was ever done, for the most part, I don't believe.
Yeah. I mean, these are healthy animals that are coming out of animal breeding labs, or they're captured in the wild in the case of primates. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of sick animals. We have a lot of experiences that veterinarians have that are real world with ill animals. That's part of the process. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a system of making animals sick, seeing what the reaction is, and then predicting or hoping that it will predict how that drug or how that set of actions will, you know, fare for humans. And what we've seen from the data, which the director of NIH, Francis Collins, his predecessor, Elias, I think it's Hirani, they said the animal models have failed. Any objective measure of the animal models shows that they are not predictive. So, as I said, it went on for a long time, even though there was this overwhelming data on the failure of that model, because that's what we did forever. There was inertia, and there was just kind of a bureaucratic response. This is the best we've got. Meanwhile, biotech companies were developing these new human biology-based methods that, when they were actually held up to compare them in terms of the results to the animal tests, were very superior. And that's really what Dr. McCarry is counting on for the future of drug development. This is going to have enormous consequences for health and well-being and drug pricing in the United States. I mean, I'm ecstatic because animals are going to be taken out of the equation, but I also just think that it's going to be just an immense benefit for the whole of society.
I believe you're right about that. To learn more, where can people go to find information for the Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action?
Well, these are two groups that I lead, Steve. Thank you for mentioning them. Animal Wellness Action is a public policy group. Go to animalwellnessaction.org. And the Center for Humane Economy drives corporate changes, like getting pharmaceutical companies to try to use these non-animal testing methods. That's centerforahumaneeconomy.org.
Wayne Pacelli, always good to talk to you. Thank you. It's that time of year. And people that are allergic to cats are, in fact, you are a part of the most common allergy there is, or one of them anyway, on the planet. But you're not allergic to what you think you're allergic to. Most people think, oh, it's the cat hair or the dander of the cat. No. It's a protein on the saliva that you're actually allergic to. And now, here's the good news. Purina has created a cat food for you because it prevents you from having an allergic response, or at least it diminishes those allergies you have to cats. It's called Purina Pro Plan Live Clear. And what it does is it negates the protein that is called FELD1 that causes the allergic response in people. Isn't that incredible? Purina Pro Plan Live Clear. You can find it wherever pet foods are sold. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.